Founded in 1982, LucasArts are among the best known and best loved game developers of the past four decades. At first, the company began as the Lucasfilm Computer Division, existing as a somewhat experimental new venture for George Lucas. As such, he became one of the few names to achieve ubiquitous fame in the worlds of both cinema and gaming. Although the movies of Lucasfilm include Star Wars, Indiana Jones, Labyrinth, The Land Before Time, and many more, LucasArts have built their own legacy entirely. Of course, many of those movies have seen video game adaptations from LucasArts, and you can hear more about Star Wars and Indiana Jones in particular in the previous episode of this series. But the developers were celebrated for their own innovations above all, from early titles like Maniac Mansion and Habitat, which amazingly functioned as an online RPG in the late 80s, to a string of inspired adventure games through the 90s, each with their own cast of vivid, original characters. The success of LucasArts games is directly matched by the technical feats they often performed. Professionals employed by the company were always driven to experiment and find new ways of doing things, usually resulting in highly impressive production values and great gameplay to boot. iMuse, a revolutionary system for implementing music and sound that reacted to the movements of the player, is a prime example of that spirit. It came years before Banjo-Kazooie, which is often considered a key development in dynamic scores, and directly influenced that release's legendary composer, Grant Kirkhope. In many ways, some of today's most complex soundtracks are still playing catch-up to the capabilities of iMuse, and the composers who worked with it consistently pushed video game audio to its very limits. I'm Lee Tyrrell, and this is The Sound Test, where I look in depth at video game audio and music, along with the very people who crafted it. Following on from my previous episode, this podcast is the second part of a dedicated LucasArts triple bill. This time, I explore the company's history with returning guests Clint Bajakian and Peter McConnell. While Clint and Peter both proved invaluable to LucasArts through the 90s and beyond, it's a true honour to also be joined by George the Fat Man Sanger, a true VGM veteran with many more appearances to come in this season. George's work with LucasArts goes back to Maniac Mansion in the 80s, the first game to be both developed and published by the team. Besides that distinction, the release is known for profoundly influencing the development of point-and-click adventures. Yet, despite being nearly 35 years old, when Maniac Mansion hit the home computer market in 1987, gaming had already seen significant ups and downs. Famously, the video game crash of 83 led to a devastating two-year recession, which threatened to put an end to the industry permanently. Unfortunately, George was directly affected by that widespread collapse. He had written music for several Intellivision and Atari titles, like Thin Ice and Capture the Flag, and had no idea that work in video games was on the brink of a very real drought. Atari ended up as one of the crash's worst casualties, but it wasn't too long before the Nintendo Entertainment System brought its own boom. That console offered George a perfect opportunity to return to VGM, and not least through a port of Maniac Mansion, among many others. Though the 1983 crash predates any of his work with LucasArts themselves, what was his experience living through it, and how did it lead to his association with the company?
Oh, it was a perfectly horrible feeling. Had no idea what I was... these things happen every once in a while. You know, you're swinging on a vine through the jungle, like Tarzan, and you at some point, you know, you let go of the vine, and the vine breaks, and you're flying through the air, and you're looking for that next vine, and you really don't know if where it is or if it's there. And this was one of those feelings. I did Thin Ice first, and that felt great. And I got a nice contract for that, sort of accidentally. I did Capture the Flag, and then there was another Atari demo cartridge that I was working on. But, you know, shortly after I did Thin Ice, Intellivision went out of business. Shortly after I did Capture the Flag, Sirius Software went out of business, and it was years before I really got even paid a fraction of what I'd asked for. The Atari demo project never really came to fruition, and I had thought that it was me being cursed, you know, once again, that egocentric point of view that turns out not to be really that accurate. But I felt like, I felt, seriously, I just felt it was bad luck, but it was actually an industry-wide crash. And I think that was around the time I might have been, trying a lot of things. I was working in a recording studio for a guy named Van Webster, who is still one of my very best friends. We jam all the time. I was recording some of the first... recording the masters for some of the first compact discs. So I was doing that kind of work around then. But I really kind of was a bit lost. I ended up getting my brother at the time, well, he's still my brother, but at the time, one of my brothers, he's kind of a nature brother and a science brother, Rick. And he had gone to the South Pole a couple of times, which was not really available to anybody who wasn't like working on the little research base that they had there. So one time he got a job sweeping runways, basically, and another time they needed a cook. So he said, yes, I can cook, but he really couldn't. So he just went down there. Can you imagine being like, you know, 20 guys under the ice, and then you look at the one guy who's supposed to be the cook, and he's like, actually, fake it till you make it. Oh, dude. But he brought a Timex Sinclair computer with him, and he was learning Forth, and he was poking and peeking into that thing, and he finally figured out how to make it put a pixel onto the screen. So with that information, he got in touch with one of the people who I believe wrote the book that he was using on Forth, Bill Volk, and Bill put him in touch with a company he was working for, and basically Rick ended up programming one of the first, maybe the first, color paint programs for a personal computer. And Rick's interfaces were really terrible, and so I got pulled in. You know, I gave him a couple of ideas for what he should do, and I got pulled in to be the interface designer for that. So for a moment there, I actually had a really nice gig creating the first color paint programs for personal PCs. And I've got some sweet video of demonstrating that, and artists gathering around, and me saying, you know, I've got a friend who's an artist who thinks that computers might be the future of art. And these guys are like, really? Wow. You know, and I zoom in and change the color of like one pixel. So anyway, that was the thing that kind of held me through that. But that petered out as well for various reasons. One was that it was only running on a Epson QX10 rather than a PC due to some business reasons and deals and constrictions. So I ended up, so that's 84 or so. I moved to Texas in 86. And then it was once the NES. Oh, and I found myself selling T-shirts. Actually, back when I was still in LA, I was trying to sell a book of puns about sheep called Sheep Thrills. You know, I was really kind of grasping at straws. And by the time that my wife and I tried learning Forth. It's an obscure language. It was invented to control telescopes. But we learned that, and we tried developing our own Mac software. We moved to Texas. I ended up selling T-shirts for an old school friend of mine. And it felt a little bit destitute, and I was trying to produce bands, and I thought that with my big CD credits and studio credits from LA, that everyone would think that I was, you know, a hotshot, and I would be the boss of the town. But that didn't work, you know. And I was telling my brother I thought I was gonna be the big cigar smoking. I was gonna be the guy who said you'll never work in this town again. I was gonna run things. I was gonna be the fat man of Boston. And that was where the name actually came from. But let me see if I can close some of these parentheses. I got an MT32 and was producing MIDI tracks. And once MIDI became available to me, I was producing MIDI tracks for vocal teachers, for people who were writing songs. And that was when Dave Warhol, who had hired me for Thin Ice, resurfaced. He said, the Nintendo system is doing really well. I need you for some gigs. So that was when I started getting Dick Tracy and Total Recall and Rad Gravity and things like that. And I was very eager not to let that slip through my fingers again. So I worked very hard to try to keep those gigs and to try to do a really, really good job on them. A little bit of the fear of God was in me. So that's a bit of the emotional temperature. I don't know if that transmits it well for you.
Since that major crash in 1983, the gaming industry has largely thrived and survived through a number of console wars that continue to this day. Therefore, with Maniac Mansion, LucasArts chose the right time to start publishing their own titles. The release proved massively popular over time, bolstered in part by a series of ports for Nintendo, Atari, and Amiga systems. George came on board with LucasArts in 1988, specifically for an NES version of Maniac Mansion, which saw him contribute music as part of a wider audio team.
Dave Warhol was my connection to that world again. I think the first thing that he steered me to was Maniac Mansion. So Maniac Mansion, and I didn't write all of it. Warhol had another composer write some, and I'm sorry, I've forgotten his name. Me and my little team of composers was just starting to work with Dave Govett, and he wrote a couple of themes. I wrote a couple of themes, I'm very proud of that work. I'm very happy about it, how it turned out. Then I think I think what came next in that saga was that I got some communication from Hal Barwood about a proposed game called Robots and one called Big Sky Trooper. And I have somewhere in my archives that are still in Texas at the University of Texas, there's a videotape of a BST walk-around. But I did not get that gig. But I think that was before Brian Moriarty got together with me and we did Loom.
Loom, released in 1990, is an important title in the LucasArts catalogue. Though their games before that point still showed an undoubtedly innovative spirit, Loom was their most experimental title yet. Filled with twists on established point-and-click tropes, and packaged with a wealth of extra lore. Along with an impressive notebook for players to record in-game spells, or drafts, they'd learned, Loom included an audio tape that expanded on the narrative and featured an enhanced version of George Sanger's OST. For that project, George converted sections of Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake for MIDI instrumentation, and it was an ambitious undertaking, which took a lot of care and attention to get right. Though VGM already had a growing community of fans by the end of the 80s, not many would have thought that such rudimentary sounds were capable of convincing classical dynamics. Now, even producers might struggle to identify well-sampled orchestral sounds, thanks, in part, to video games like Loom.
The main thing was that it was clearly a feeling that I was raising the bar. So even if I wasn't able to beat those aspects of it, I still felt like I was moving forward. And the reason for that is this, that all the classical music, basically all the MIDI files that had gotten to me, everything that I'd ever heard was recorded at a constant tempo and without regard to dynamics. MIDI was just that early and that sort of underutilized. So by first of all having Tchaikovsky's wonderful music available to me and made the assignment. Second, by having an MT32, which would give me actual timbres that sounded pretty good, but still would have voice dropouts, as you say, you know, it couldn't handle all those voices. And third, by, excuse me for doing so, but for copying the dynamics and tempos that Seiji Ozawa was using on his recording with the LA Philharmonic. With those four elements, it sounded better than any other MIDI that, you know, around. It just sounded really, really good, better than anything I'd heard. Of course I'm ignorant. Of course there were better things out there somewhere that I don't know about. But I didn't have to deal with that. I just got to feel good.
Throughout his career, George has done an enormous amount of work with MIDI. Outside of his own compositions, he had a big hand in defining MIDI timbres, or sounds, for other musicians to use. They can be heard in some versions of Super Street Fighter II, as just one prominent example. George's credits are filled with such roles, where he wrote no music whatsoever, including acting several times as a producer. Zombies Ate My Neighbours, developed by LucasArts in 1993, features an audio production credit for George. But the tunes themselves were mostly handled by Joe McDermott. So how exactly did such an arrangement work behind the scenes?
I might be a little over credited as producer. Here's the credit I'll take for producer. I put that little team of cowboy composers together. Kevin Phelan, Dave Govett, and Joe McDermott, who was the primary composer on Zombies Ate My Neighbors. And part of the fun of putting that together was to decide, okay, we're going to be the Beatles of game audio. And we're gonna have a treehouse, you know, a clubhouse tree fort, and we're gonna do fun stuff, and we're gonna dress up in cowboy clothes, and we're gonna bring heart and soul to music, and you know, this is at a time when game music was not a thing; it was not a legitimate career path. So Joe was writing his serious music. He was writing children's music better than anybody else that I knew about. And my role was to make sure that he took game music absolutely seriously and that he had a hope that someday someone would go back and listen to this stuff and go, oh man, this has moved my heart. You know, and my role was to convince this team and to make sure that they kept their eye on this idea that game audio could actually mean something to somebody and that it was a legitimate platform. So, you know, this was in a time I would run into people who would say, you know, game composers who've got some pretty good credits, who would say, well, George, if I wrote anything that was any good, do you think I'd give it to these guys? You know, so these are guys who, you know, who were holding back on what they would write for games. There were people who would write for games the most game-like thing they could think of, which was, you know, the more it could sound like the ice cream truck or, you know, the earliest games, that was all they could think about. Because they're like, oh, well, I guess that's what's expected. That's what they want. But for us, it was like, okay, we are gonna take rock and roll and add sitars. You know, we're going to do like the Beatles did. We're going to put in spiritual elements. We're going to sneak in lyrical. We're going to sneak our philosophies into the lyrics where we can. We're going to show people what friendship and brotherhood is. You know, we're going to put all this in. So I would, when my team would do something, even if it was largely under one person's command, which Zombies Ate My Neighbors mainly was under Joe's command. My main role was to come in to his studio, nod my head sagely, and say, you're on the right track, man. You do it. Give it your best. And he did. So that's me producing. Well, I'm tempted to say I didn't do anything, but you know, even the first thing I produced was this. There's a 45 RPM record by a band called The Onlys, which was a funny little punk band, at my college. And all I did was set up the 4-track recorder and say go. But one of my friends who was in that band said, "Oh no, George. You know, as a producer, I remember your spirit pervaded everything and everything you know and somehow." I guess you just needed I don't know if I really did anything, but look, I was like this, like I am with you. And somehow that kept things from being industrial or overly academic or mechanical or sad or negative. Something happens maybe when I'm around a musical situation that makes it, I want to say better, but even just different. I mean, even just take on some of the George personality. Something happens. So I didn't do nothing. But maybe I did. If I can give 5 minutes like that to what I contributed to Zombies Ate My Neighbors, think of the hours we could give to what Joe McDermott contributed to Zombies Ate My Neighbors. I know what I did. I made a safe place for that brilliant guy to do something very free and creative.
Except for Zombies Ate My Neighbors, Loon, and Maniac Mansion, George only contributed to one other LucasArts game, the rather obscure Defenders of Dinatron City. One look at his work otherwise, though, makes it clear just how prolific he is. That's why you'll hear from George many more times in the remainder of this series, discussing dynamic music, the Amiga demo scene, and more. By 1991, LucasArts had employed Michael Land, Clint Bajakian, and Peter McConnell, who became synonymous with the company for the next 10 years. Between them, they're responsible for almost every LucasArts OST from the 90s, either individually or as a team. Due to the release of Zombies Ate My Neighbors in 93, however, that trio were well acquainted with George Sanger and rubbed shoulders with him on several occasions. When I mentioned to Clint that George would be included in this episode, he remembered their meetings fondly.
Well, you know, I'll tell you a quick story about him. Well, first of all, two things. One, I used to go to his Project Barbecues, which are, you'll learn all about if you don't know already about them. But he would rent out a dude ranch in Texas that companies would go to for retreats and things. So they have conference facilities and things, but it's also really fun, right? And so hardware and software industry people would get together. So I used to go and get to know him very well from that. And while visiting in Texas one time, he and I followed through on a long-held goal. We went to the Alamo and drank whiskey and smoked cigars at the Alamo. So that was, number one, a big achievement with George. And then the other funny thing is he visited us here in California. And when I say us, Michael, Peter, and I, the four of us were very close friends, actually. And we really admired each other's work. And we're talking like mid-90s. And we went out and went to a shooting range and shot guns together, the four of us. And then we went out and went out drinking. We went to a bar and had beers and whatever else and drank together. And when he reported on this, I think it was in his book. I can't remember what the format was where he reported on this, basically in a public forum. He said, "I don't know what's with these LucasArts guys. We went shooting and then we went drinking. Do they have to do everything backwards?" Yeah, he thought that the Texas way would be drinking and shooting. So, but anyway, George is just a funny guy and a wonderful guy.
Clint Bajakian himself joined LucasArts as an in-house composer at the same time as Peter McConnell, and for the same project, Monkey Island 2, LeChuck's Revenge. Both worked alongside Michael Land for that title, who kicked off his own VGM career with the very first Monkey Island. The three actually knew each other long before composing together for video games, and you can hear that strong, established relationship in their earliest OSTs. The fact that they all knew each other well, ahead of collaborating for LucasArts, was no coincidence either. So how did Clint join the team?
I went to high school in Concord, Massachusetts in 1976. I entered as a freshman, and one of the first people I met was Michael Land. He heard me playing guitar, and for some reason, even though I was a real beginner, he felt that I had some talent and sort of pulled me into a band. And we played mostly Grateful Dead music, and it was very interesting to actually, you know, looking back, to be playing Grateful Dead music in the mid-70s is kind of something when you think about it. So we were playing it when the band was playing it, you know, but as kids. But we became best of friends, and he went out to California, attended Mills College, and then I visited him in the Bay Area, and I believe that was 1990. And he took me around George Lucas's Skywalker Ranch, and I looked around. I had never been to California, and I looked around at the hills and the natural beauty, and I said, "Michael, this is incredible. And if you ever need help writing music for these games, just let me know, and I'll be here in a heartbeat." At that time, in a master's program in music composition at the University of Michigan. So composition was my main thing. We left it at that, and nothing really came of it for a while. And the next year, I graduated and was working at a caterer's company. It just it just goes to show you, you can get an advanced degree in music and it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get out of school and start working in music and making money. And Michael gave me a call. He said, "Clint, you know how all of our games have required 5 minutes of music because they were all played over the PC speaker, just the little size of a dime, you know?" He said, "Well, we've gone up to needing 5 hours of music per title now because there are these new sound cards that people can buy and put in their computer to make sound. However primitive it was, certainly compared to motion pictures, it was sound. And so now the games required wall-to-wall, we used to call it carpeting, wall-to-wall carpeting, just music as far as the eye could see. So I do need you. Can you see your way clear to coming out to California for $20 an hour and working with us on these games?" I said, "Absolutely." So my, at that time, fiance, Denise Ince, who was also a composer in the same program, got in the car and drove out to California. And that was 1991, and we've been out here ever since. And my career at LucasArts lasted all the way till 2000 when I left and went independent.
Like Clint, Peter McConnell's association with LucasArts started in 1991 at the behest of his friend, Michael Land. Apparently, Michael had a good ear for quality musicians, since both continue to work in the industry as I record this and have composed more classic soundtracks than I can practically mention. The three remain close friends too, as their time at LucasArts only strengthened the bond between them. So, what are Peter's memories of Michael and Clint before they all reunited for video game OSTs?
Michael was my housemate when we were undergraduates at Harvard, and we were both music majors. And we would jam together. He had musical friends he played music with, and I would join that, and vice versa. And he helped me out on my senior honors thesis. He helped record some of the instrument parts for my senior honors thesis. I guess it was actually his now that I think of it, his voice is on my senior honors thesis. But anyway. Point is, a long story short, we were, you know, musical collaborators and friends, and after we both graduated, I got a job at Lexicon, which is an audio company in Massachusetts, not too far from Cambridge, and it was really exciting for me because it was I was actually doing something related to real audio and getting paid for it. And Michael went and got a master's degree at Mills in electronic music, and then came back to Boston, and we And I sort of helped him get a job at Lexicon. So we worked together. We were actually housemates at the time. So a lot of history there. We hatched this plan. Clint Pajakian was involved, who would also join us at LucasArts. And in any case, we had no idea about what we were going to be doing for work, but we did want to form a band together. And so Michael and Clint and I and another musician, Bob Greco, a Massachusetts guitar player, we had this idea that we were going to go out to the Bay Area and form a band and you know, try to make it in music. Well, we weren't all able to go out there at once, so Michael went out first, and he needed to find gainful employment. So he answered this ad in the paper. People used to answer ads in the paper in those days for an audio position at LucasArts. It was called Lucasfilm Games in those days. And that's really how it all started. By the time I got out there, I also needed gainful employment. And, you know, we were a little bit more of a rare item in those days in that we were musicians who had some audio programming background, having worked at Lexicon. So it was, you know, we were in the right place at the right time. And Michael brought me in one day. I was, you know, doing my thing and doing some consulting work for Lexicon, and Michael said, you know, you really need to come in and see what I'm doing here, because it's pretty interesting stuff. It's a new thing. We got to figure out how to write music that's going to play interactively in a game. And I thought, wow, that sounds like an awesome problem to try to solve. And what's more, it's even closer to music than doing audio, straight audio programming. So, and music, as you might guess, has really always been my first love. So, you know, I started working with Michael on a consulting basis, and we came up with this system that later was used to score games like Monkey Island and Indiana Jones, The Fate of Atlantis, and Grim Fandango, and so on. So that's kind of how it all started. It was, you know, sort of this gentle version of the Old Boys Network, I suppose you would say.
Collaboration is relatively rare in VGM, especially in the 80s and 90s. Indeed, it's somewhat harder to jam or share ideas in a setting that calls for coded and sequenced music. The trio of Michael Land, Clint Pajakian, and Peter McConnell is one of the more well-known examples of game composers working as a group, and their results speak for themselves. Of course, knowing each other before joining LucasArts was important to their success. But what was their process when writing together, and why did it work so well?
We would collaborate very closely, meeting at least one or two or three times, not necessarily in a sit-down hour-long meeting, but, you know, touching base and having brief huddles or conversations. Certainly lunch was always an opportunity to connect up our thinking and collaborate. But we would also go to each other's writing studios and listen to what the other composer was working on and give suggestions or feedback. We would even, and this is unusual, I will say, I've heard of other people doing this, but it generally, other than collaborations like Hans Zimmer has with an electronic musician in London, I understand, I apologize for forgetting the gentleman's name at the moment, but that's a very formal way of working where, you know, the composition is traded back and forth. And because that's the formal method by which it's being written, because each artist brings a different strength to the table. We would do it not so much from that standpoint of Pete does this really well and I do that really well, so let's share a piece. We would just do it as a kind of a strategic logistical thing. Pete might have meetings that afternoon or need to work on something else, and he's in the middle of a composition, and he'll just send it off to me. I'll finish it up. Invariably, we would like what each other did with our compositions that we started. I can give you an example of Sam and Max Hit the Road. Pete wrote the thematic melody that ended up being the main melody in that game. And yet I was really pretty much the sole composer through the game, but Peter had set up a number of themes and musical ideas that then I adapted and made my own. So we were each other's orchestrators, we were each other's arrangers, we were writing partners, a bunch of the music would actually go through more than one of us. Generally, though, each piece of music was written just by one person, generally. But the last thing to say about that as well is that we were also very aware of the differences in our three styles and how those differences could actually be leveraged to have a variety in the score. So, for example, Monkey Island 2 was comprised of three islands. I think they were called Booty Island and Scum Island, or Booty Island and I can't remember. But there were three distinct islands. We set it up where each composer had his own island. And what that did is it ensured, first of all, it was a very practical way to divide the work up, but it also ensured that each island had kind of that different thumbprint of personal style, that when the player would go to these different islands, they would have that sort of individual sound, each unto itself. So that was a kind of an example of where we both would work together seamlessly as much as possible to coordinate our styles, but we would also leverage the differences between our individual styles.
It's funny because, you know, there are people out there that know my stuff from that era better than I do, because it's a long time ago. And sometimes we listen to that. Mike and Clint and I will listen to something like, did you write that? And I don't know. Did you write that? It has been some years. But, for Monkey 2, we did have islands that were, I'm remembering some of them now. I think mine was Booty Island, if I remember right, and Clint's was Fat Island. Booty was the one with Wood Tick on it. Anyway, whatever. We had different islands, so we did have sort of different domains where we did slightly different but related types of music. But we also were perfectly happy sharing pieces, and we would like the let me think. Yeah, like, for instance, the Largo theme is, I wrote the head and Michael wrote the bridge. And we just put them together. Because if, like, we get somewhere, we would, you know, if we got stuck, we'd say, hey, I'm stuck, you know, can you do anything with this? And so we actually would, it was a full-on collaboration that way. That was really great in terms of learning how to get a consistent sound and learning how to collaborate and work together. But we also, there was also a certain amount of inefficiency with that way of doing things. And we just found that the next natural step was for us to take each composer to take on a project by himself. So one of the first projects, Sam and Max was kind of a handoff in that sense, where I wrote a few themes and then Clint finished the game.
As time rolled on, it became increasingly necessary for Michael, Clint, and Peter to work individually. The 90s were a particularly busy time for LucasArts, filled with back-to-back releases of classic games. Giving in-house musicians specific projects to compose for was one way of accounting for that increased output, though it also allowed the team to focus their talents. Peter McConnell soon came out with impressive soundtracks like Full Throttle, and later, career-defining works like Grim Fandango. Clint, on the other hand, established himself with the Western-inspired Outlaws before juggling duties with several composers for Star Wars games and eventually working as a music supervisor. Both Clint and Peter have had to adapt to a range of different styles as projects have come and gone, too. From the pirate reggae of Monkey Island to the orchestral weight of John Williams. Considering how important versatility is when writing VGM, how did LucasArts musicians approach different genres?
I think the fact that we were also, it's sort of a weird phrase to use, but pop musicians, in that we played rock and roll and we played folk music and things on guitars and in the context of bands and things like that, we sort of understood a more sophisticated orchestral, musical language, which is really kind of the Western civilization, phenomenon that evolved over hundreds of years. So you can go study the Mozart, you can study the Beethoven, we had done that. But then also, we understood what it was to have drums and bass and keyboards. And so I think that really helped, number one. Number two, I will definitely cite Peter as somebody who's just phenomenal in this. You can ask him, hey, what is it that makes Oscar Peterson like or swing? What is it about 40s swing? And he will answer the question in very specific musical terms. He'll talk about the syncopation. He'll talk about the role of the bass and how it's different from other forms of jazz. Because in this genre of jazz, the bass does this and it tends to play off the second beat and blah, blah, blah. He'll go on about the different specific stylistic features of the different instruments in the ensemble and the way it all fits together rhythmically in the meter. And as a result, if you look at a score like Grim Fandango of Pete's, you can see what an assiduous grasp he had on that style of jazz, and he had internalized it and understood it from an intellectual standpoint. So I think that we really did that too, and we talked a lot, at lunch or whatever, and we socialized with each other too. We were best of friends. We even played in bands together back in Massachusetts. So the three of us were already established friends and fellow musicians, even before connecting under Michael at LucasArts. But I think that's the answer. I think it was that all three of us had appreciated music our whole lives, listened to it closely, made it something that was just naturally fun for us to analyze and talk about our analyses with each other and compare notes. And I think that was the sort of the driving force behind our ability to sink so deeply into these different styles. And often it was the first time that we had addressed such a style. I mean, I wrote Outlaws in 1997, and I had never written in a spaghetti western Ennio Morricone style before, but I was able to understand what Maestro Morricone had achieved and how the stylistic facets of that music, and then was able to go in and manipulate those facets myself in my own way. And I think that's what we did. I think we were all very scholarly in our approach to music, and it helped us traverse the different styles.
The Wild West-inspired Outlaws is a true highlight of Clint's music, and a great example of his ability to compose for a variety of distinct styles. Outlaws released in 1997, just when CDs had fully established themselves as the dominant format for video games. With that technical step forward came a vast growth in VGM, as live instrumentation took over the principles of simple waveforms and FM synthesis. Developers also began taking music more seriously, and LucasArts were, as usual, ahead of the curve by actually including the tracklist of Outlaws' soundtrack in certain physical editions. It's well known that many CD-based titles from the time could double as OSTs, to be played in cars, home stereos, or any other disc drive. There's a whole episode to come on that subject in this podcast series, where I explore the extra pressures felt by audio professionals at the turn of the century. So what was the general feeling around LucasArts during the creation of Outlaws?
There was a number of factors that contributed to Outlaws coming out, I think, and I'm very gratified to hear, even still today, from individuals throughout different countries and the world, which is really, really gratifying, Outlaws being a successful score. There was a number of factors that contributed to that. One of them was that the director, Darren Stinnett, who had also directed Dark Forces a few years earlier, he had a philosophy as a leader of leveraging the talent of his leads. So when it came to art questions, graphics questions, he looked to his lead artist. When it came to the music, he looked to me. When it came to game design questions, he would look to his lead designer and, of course, himself. But he really leveraged the talent of his team around us. And not to name names, but today there are some prominent leaders who very conspicuously do not leverage the talent of those around them. And you can see the failure that results from that. So it's a very powerful thing to utilize the talents of the people that report up to you and are responsible for the different aspects of a project. And Darren was very much like that. And when you're trusted like that, you want to do a great job, and you reach inside yourself and you come up with creative ideas. You don't feel like you're trying to always please somebody. You feel like you've been given the reins, and what can you do? How high can you jump? You know, how cool can your ideas be? So it's just a tremendous, right off the bat, the stage was set really wonderfully there. And of course, secondly, the music of Ennio Morricone in the Spaghetti Westerns, Good and Bad and the Ugly, The Fistful of Dollars, For a Few Dollars More, Once Upon a Time in the West. These are the most innovative, deep, rich, imaginative scores in the history of film. I mean, at least some of them, and of the very top ones. The use of instrumentation, I call it kind of kitchen sink instrumentation, where literally even the kitchen sink is in the score. Player piano, kazoo, men sort of doing visceral grunts in the background, beautiful solo female vocals, banjos. I mean, you name it. There's so much that's just put in, and it becomes extremely inventive and imaginative. So that's the second thing, to be able to work in that genre and take a big page out of Ennio Morricone's work and then go off and try to do it in my own way was huge. Then lastly, I sat down and had a big piece of paper, and sometimes I do this, I'll diagram out concepts and procedures, and sometimes there are circles and arrows and squares and It can be kind of diagrammatic. And I realized as very shortly after I had been entrusted with the role of lead composer on this project, I sat down and planned out, and what I realized, and we had just recently become ready for this, perhaps as an industry, but certainly at LucasArts, and I think truly as an industry as well, in that we were now streaming digital audio, and this was going to be a Redbook audio score, meaning CD tracks. So that was pretty much the highest resolution audio of our time.
When I spoke to Clint for this series, we talked a lot more about his soundtrack for Outlaws. However, much of that material is better suited to an upcoming Redbook special, in which we'll get a bit more technical about the specs of such a format. For now, after discussing one of Clint's best-loved OSTs, let's continue into 1998. It was then that LucasArts released Grim Fandango, the acclaimed culmination of all the company's most innovative developments. On that occasion, the music was composed by Peter McConnell, who recorded some of his most enduring themes for the project. By then, it was possible, and somewhat expected, to play with any live instrumentation you liked when writing for games. Therefore, it's no surprise that Peter made use of guitar, clarinets, lots of different brass and percussion, and a whole range of intriguing obscurities, like the charango. Many of these were performed by professionals and session musicians, but just how much freedom were they given to improvise?
Quite a bit, and that was a lesson too. Because, for example, one of the guys I worked with, a guy named Ralph Carney, he's an incredible player. He's a reed player. He's played for Beck and Tom Waits, and I mean, I saw him in concert with Beck, and I saw him just by himself in the Mission District in San Francisco, which used to be the sort of big hopping jazz area. So he was incredibly intuitive and a monster, monster player, monster technician on the instrument. But he seemed to, and it took me a while to sort of catch on to this, he seemed to kind of recoil to the written page. It wasn't that he couldn't read, it's that he didn't like to. That's my interpretation. I have no idea. I've never asked him about this. But what I do know is that in the session, I had written out a solo for him, which now, to me, is so hilarious. But I wrote this ridiculous sort of, I mean, it was an okay solo for a composed solo. And, you know, and he just like sort of struggled with it for an hour or so. Or not an hour. It was probably more like a few minutes. But it seemed like an hour because of how painful it was for everybody involved. And finally, it dawned on me, being a little slow on the uptake and not that experienced at the time, that this was wrong. That I shouldn't. So I just, pressed the talk back button and said, okay, now that you've done that, just do what you do. And oh boy, what a difference. So he played the head, which was, I'm thinking of a particular piece where he played the head, which was composed out. But when he started to take it somewhere with improvisation, it was just incredible. So that was a huge lesson. And I do like to compose stuff out a lot for players, but knowing what the best result is going to be, the final thing that really meets what your concept was, is very much a dance that you do sort of in real time in the studio, where you're kind of feeling out what the player is comfortable with and where they really want to take it, and whether, in fact, you might be better doing everything precisely as written, or you might just be so much better off if you get some, you know, wild off-the-cuff thing. Trango was a gift from Tim's brother to Tim. His brother passed away, and it was a kind of a special thing. So I played that, and it was definitely a big part, not only because it was came from Tim and it was special in that way, but I was very much influenced by this CD by Gustavo Santaolalla called Ron Rocco. A Ron Rocco is a kind of a charango. And I just listened to it over and over again, and it definitely informed the Andean aspect of Grimm a fair amount. And it was really cool to actually play that on a real charango, because you can't get that sound. You can sort of fake it on a mandolin if you play it with your, you know, bare fingers or something, but it's just not the same. It's an armadillo shell with these gut strings stretched over it, and it's a very particular sound.
Due to its popularity, Grim Fandango has since been remastered by Double Fine Productions, who gave the game a loving polish, complete with fresh recordings from Peter McConnell himself. Yet Peter and Clint had left LucasArts as in-house musicians by the end of the 2000s. Then, the company had a strong focus on Star Wars games, and their previously successful point-and-click adventures slowly petered out in favour of them. Unfortunately, the coming years, up to 2013, were more of a critical struggle, and the end of LucasArts was signalled, largely, by the Walt Disney Company's acquisition of their assets and staff. But their achievements, from the video game crash of the 80s through an especially prolific period in the 90s, remain influential and important. That's exactly why they required this unprecedented three-parter for the sound test, and even then, there's so much more to discuss. Don't miss the next episode, in which George, Clint, Peter and I discuss the development of iMuse in depth, and you'll be able to hear even more about the creative spirit that always drove LucasArts.
You had to innovate, you still do in this industry. You have to push the hardware, and you have to be as trendsetting and on the cutting edge as you can. And so everything was as though for the first time. And frankly, everything was literally for the first time, to be honest. Every day was a brand new set of challenges that needed to be solved. And we really were aggressive in that spirit of innovation as a team. And Michael, Peter, and I particularly were very close and worked as a very close unit. We referred to ourselves as the Three Stooges. And we were very clear on who was Moe and who was Larry and who was Curly. Well, the funny thing is, while Pete didn't have much hair, he still wasn't Curly. I was Curly. Pete was certainly Larry, and there's no question that Mike was Moe.
It was definitely, it was worth the care and trouble that we took to do it. But someone who's an audiophile who's just listening to music, it might seem a little crazy. that was, the world of games was a very, a niche world. It was a small world, and with a great amount of love and appreciation for what could be done with the tools at hand. And I think that's why those titles from that era are still, I mean, you know, if you had told me that I'd be talking, you know, to the press about Monkey Island 2, what is it, 20, almost 30 years later? And I feel like you got to be kidding me. That's crazy. Because the games industry, it wasn't this giant entertainment behemoth that it is now. It was a little tiny sandbox for geeks. And people wore it like, you know, people made fun of it. And you wore it like a badge of honor that, you know, hey, really, there's something cool going on here, you know. And there's always a little bit of that around games, but in those days it was really extreme because it wasn't a this big part of the popular culture. It was just making that transition as you know, the years that I was at LucasArts were either as an employee or just working as a consultant were like 91 to 2000. So maybe late 91. So you know, 9 years or so, the whole industry just changed from being something in someone's garage to this huge thing.
Like almost all the papers and faxes and notes that I exchanged with all the people over all these years that we're talking about exist at the University of Texas Center for American History, a Briscoe Center, Video Game Archive, George Sanger papers. I don't know what the routine is for actually seeing them, but let's just make a note that for the person 100 years from now who says, wait a minute, this doesn't coincide with what I think happened and with what, you know, Mark Miller came back and he wrote the definitive history of this, and it doesn't match you know, Lee's version. So you know, which one's right? Well, you people, I'm talking to you 100 years from now, that go over to the UT and check out the record, and you can see how it looked to me. So that does exist there.
Thanks to George, Clint, and Peter for speaking to me for the sound test. But thank you too for taking the time to listen. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please make sure to follow or subscribe on whatever platform you may be listening on. There are still many episodes to come in this second series, and the first season is freely available through most popular podcast providers. Next up, I'll be joined by the same talented trio as you've heard in this episode, for the third and final part of my ST2 LucasArts special. To finish up the sound test's only three-parter, we'll take an extended look at the evolution of dynamic music. Since we explore the subject through the lens of LucasArts, expect to hear a lot of details about iMuse. However, we also discuss some of George Sanger's earlier generative soundtracks and modern-day systems that were directly influenced by iMuse. If you'd like to hear my interviews early, ahead of public release, head on over to patreon.com/_secretcave. There, you can pledge your support for as little as a single pound or dollar to unlock unedited conversations, full quality WAV files, a backlog of otherwise unavailable live shows, and more. Either way, I hope you enjoyed this edition of ST2, and don't forget to join me for the next.